Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Levo. Simple, potent, at-home herbal infusions at the push of a button. Learn more at levooil.com and feed your enthusiasm. That's levooil.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're looking at things that have changed and things that are still in flux. From mothers balancing new lifestyles to the social stigma surrounding pumpkin spice.
You got rid of the star rating system and talked about, like, I'm not going to use the word ethnic when I talk about food.
They recognized that safety was our motivation, and they were very, you know, receptive to the changes, understanding what we were trying to accomplish.
A cupcake or a piece of bacon or a glass of rosé is not inherently gendered.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It is a beautiful Sunday here in Brooklyn, New York, where I am, and we're in the midst of fall, but heading into the colder weather, this is the time of year that I really want to cook lots of soups and stews and rib-sticking hearty dishes, but I also want to do that in a vegetarian way. Like so many people today, including the author I'm speaking to today, I'm not a strict vegetarian or a vegan, but I strive to eat that way often because I know it can be just as satisfying as meat. And it's, you know, meat is not the end all be all of winter comfort food anyway. And it's also just, you know, often more economical, healthful, and environmentally beneficial. So I'm thrilled to talk about a book that I think you will all love if you're trying to eat this way or not. It's called East, 120 Vegan and Vegetarian Recipes from Bangalore to Beijing. And its author, Mira Soda, is a best-selling cookbook author in the UK. She is a voracious home cook, the author of Made in India and Fresh India cookbooks. And she is the vegan columnist at The Guardian. I'm so pleased to welcome Mira to the show. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining. And I know it's about dinner time over there in where you are. So thanks for taking the time away.
You're very welcome.
So first off, in the introduction to East, you talk about how when you first got this wonderful career opportunity to write a vegan column for The Guardian, you were a little bit conflicted because you had just had your infant daughter at that time, and it was a bit of a handful. So I wanted to congratulate you, first of all, because I know that you have recently welcomed a new baby.
Thank you. I have. She's just turned 6 months old.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
So good things seem to happen to you at the same time.
Literally all the things come at once, like the London buses, three at a time.
How is everything going with juggling being a mom, and now your third cookbook just came out?
I think I've got slightly better at juggling. it's total pandemonium and chaos, but I think, you know, a lot of good things can come from chaos. It can be quite a creative environment to be in. I'm a great believer that limitations are great for creativity, and that's a main theme running through East, you know, sort mm-hmm. of, you know, using, trying to write recipes for vegan food predominantly. And I think it's the same when you have children and, you know, your days start at 5 o'clock in the morning and you're looking after children. early in the morning, and your days are shorter, and you're waking up multiple times in the night, and I think the restrictions on the time helps me to, well, in theory, focus a little bit more and be more efficient. I say in mm-hmm. theory because I'm not sure if it's actually true or if it's something that I like to be true. But
hey, if it's working,
I hope so too. I'm going to just tell myself that in the hope that it might become true.
Oh, I love that theme. Yeah, I definitely really enjoyed when you wrote that in your introduction, that you find having the constraints of not using, you know, meat, fish, dairy, or eggs, it forces you to think about food in new and creative ways and, you know, get the most out of ingredients. And do you think that that is what made so many vegan cuisines or traditionally vegetarian cuisines so delicious in the first place?
I think so. If you've only got celery root to cook with, and you know, then you're going to find the best way of extracting, you know, flavor out of it, and all the different techniques that you could use to make it the most delicious thing that you could possibly eat that day. If you've got absolutely everything at your disposal in your supermarket, and you know, now everything is aseasonal. I went to my local supermarket today and I saw asparagus and I was aghast because it's really not the season for asparagus here. But, you know, so it forces you down another channel if you've got no other options. And although that was terrifying to start with when I first started writing this column, my Guardian column that you mentioned that then turned into this book, I realized after a little while that it set me free. You know, it was just the most joyous feeling because it just meant that I focused in on a singular vegetable and could learn all about it. And it meant that I wanted to explore further. And so it opened me up to the Asian pantry and all these different new ingredients that I'd never tried before. So I think in short, the answer to your question is yes. I think that it is, you know, I think we across the world, there have been limitations, whether it's out of poverty or religion or just, you know, because people have had to eat whatever they can grow.
Seasonality.
And whatever, you know, whatever grows around them according to the land. And that is a restriction of its own kind. And so they're obviously going to try and make the most delicious food out of the situation that they're in, but we don't live in that world anymore. And I think that's a brilliant thing in some ways, but then also quite, you know, where do you start? There are billions of recipes on the internet, but we're always in search of inspiration. So that's partly why I wanted to focus as well for, you know, looking at India and beyond, was sort of just homing in on certain cuisines and cultures.
Yeah, let's talk about the scope of East, because amongst these are 120 recipes, and it also has, I should mention, this wonderful condiment section where you have a recipe for everything from a Sichuan chili oil to carrot achar to ketchup manis. I don't know if I said that right. The Indonesian ketchup manis. Anyway.
Yeah. Ketchup manis. I didn't, but it could be a. Sorry, did you have a question about the condiments? So, I mean, what happened was I was writing about Indian food, and I could spend the rest of my life writing about Indian food and barely scratch the surface. It's such an enormous country, and you know, the food of India is hyper regionalized in the same way as is the food of Italy. You know, you travel 10 miles down the road to another village, and they're making doses in a different way. So what I'd learned from looking at India was that you know, there was so much innovation when it came to vegetarian food, and particularly where my family are from in Gujarat. Gujarat is a state on the west coast of India where there's 66 million people who live there, and they're mostly vegetarian. And so they've really, you know, there's ingredients like chickpea flour, which is you know, they've used in, I mean, thousands of different ways to make breads and pancakes and, you know, you can use it to make something the equivalent of scrambled egg, and you can steam it and it becomes something else. You can stuff onions with, I mean, so I just thought if this sort of innovation exists here, then it must do east of here. And, and I, you know, I found that when I traveled to Sri Lanka, when I traveled to Thailand, that the food that I was eating was predominantly vegetarian. And when I say that, I mean, it was 99% vegetarian. So if you look at something like a Som Tam salad, you know, a sort of classic Thai salad, there's like a splash of fish sauce in there and the rest of it is vegan. And so that you'll find typically that there is a little bit of meat, or like say the Chinese dish Mapo Tofu, there's a little bit of pork mince in there, but it's predominantly a vegetarian dish. And that's most likely happened because meat is a very, was used to be a real luxury and still is for many, many people. And so you would only use a small amount to flavor a dish. And so if you're looking then to write, you know, to when I was trying to figure out the, you know, how to write the best vegan recipes that I could, most people around me or the recipes that I could see were sort of taking out meat from Western dishes like lasagna and replacing it with vegetables or tofu. And then you'd eat something like that. And I really felt like there was something missing because you haven't, you know, that you're substituting. Whereas actually, you know, removing just a little tiny bit of meat from a dish like Mapo Tofu and then understanding what that, what the role of that thing is, like the pork, and understanding how you can replace it with something that might have the same mouthfeel is, was an area that I found, you know, it was very easy because there are so many cuisines and cultures from Singapore to, and Sri Lanka, Beijing to Bangkok, where, you know, there are food cultures that with ease and creativity put plants at the center of the table. So you know, that so the song, you know, from whether it's a Som Tam salad or a Vietnamese bun cha or a Malaysian laksa. So I love laksa. You know, you talked at the beginning of this program about really wanting sort of soups and stews, and oh, me too. We've had such a sort of one of those beautiful sunny cold days here, and we went for a long walk. And I just, you know, I came back and I really wanted to make a laksa. So there are, I mean, there are many different types of, it's predominantly a sort of coconut noodle soup, Malaysian coconut noodle soup. And I just, with that dish, I've used what we call swede, what I believe you call rutabaga, if I pronounced it correctly.
Oh, yeah, rutabaga, sure.
Rutabaga, which no one eats here. It's a very unpopular vegetable. And I roasted it and realized how delicious and buttery. Oh my gosh, because the flavors concentrate when you roast it and you bring out these earthy, buttery tones. And I roasted some shallots alongside it, and it's just, it pairs so like gorgeously with this like deep, hot, like quite sort of chili hot coconut noodle soup, which it, with it, obviously the coconut sort of acts as this lovely blanket to just take the edges off the chili. So it's kind of one of those things that gets your eyes watering in a good way. Screaming and just
I love rutabaga too.
And
enough people like it here.
Exactly.
Not popular.
Exactly. But that's what I love is that people, I think maybe from previous generations, have had very particular relationships with different types of food. So I mean, I'm in a position to talk about what previous generations in the UK have felt about beetroot, as in I didn't know if they were force-fed it or if it was just eaten pickled, but no one above the age of, let's say, 55 eats beetroot.
Interesting.
I know, very strange, and it can filter down the generations. So I'm enjoying sort of, you know, trying to encourage these vegetables, these unpopular vegetables, back on people's plates.
It does seem that vegetables are very in fashion or out. So
yes, yeah.
There's Brussels sprouts. It's in full bloom here.
Oh, really?
Really? It's like very popular, but it wasn't, you know.
They really weren't. How are you eating your sprouts?
Usually I will have them and put them cut side down on a sheet pan when I'm roasting something else, like a chicken.
Or I
might shave them raw for a salad. What else should I do with them?
Well, I love shredding them and frying them, like crank the heat up high and fry them really hard for just a few minutes until you char them and bring out their bitter sweet notes. And then I like smacking them with a really like a hot, salty peanut sauce. That's I mean, whether it's, you know, soy or black vinegar, some crushed peanuts.
You have a great recipe here with the tandoori broccoli, and I think that might translate because since they're both, you know, brassicas.
I'm just trying to think if there must be a Brussels sprout recipe in here.
The kung pao cauliflower, maybe that will work.
The which cauliflower dish? Sorry, say that again.
Kung pao cauliflower in your book.
Yes, that would really work. That would really work. My mum's been cooking a sprout curry for many years.
Really?
Now. Yes, and it's she uses pickling spices, sort of classic Indian pickling spices, and the sprout takes to it very well. It's such a tender little thing. It doesn't need much cooking, and because it has all of those beautiful layers, it can really just soak up a lot of, you know, all the good stuff that's around it.
Brilliant. I need to ask you a lot more about what's in my crisper drawer and what to do with it. But Mira, we're going to just cut to a quick little commercial break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Levo, the world's most intelligent at-home infuser. It's super easy to use to make infusions for cooking, candies, cosmetics, and herbal medicines. When the box showed up, I was excited to try it out as I've heard good things about the machine. It looks like a space-age coffee maker on the counter, and having it out makes me want to infuse everything. I've got plans for the hot peppers on my counter and the sage I picked from the garden before the first freeze last week, along with some other choice herbs and spices. I think everyone on my list is going to get infused oils this year. So far, I've used it for cannabis, basil, and orange peel infused oils and butter. The machine even has dry and activate functions for the highest potency and stability in your infusions, and you can connect through Wi-Fi to track your progress and record your recipes and share with the Levo community. Learn more at levooil.com. That's levooil.com.
Okay, we're back and chatting more with Mira Soda. Her recent book is called East, and it is 120 vegan and vegetarian recipes from Bangalore to Beijing. So Mira, we were just talking about your kind of scope of this book and how you decided to expand beyond the Indian dishes that you had written about for your first two books, even though, you know, India is a big enough country to write about forever. But I love how you have really culled from Southeast and East Asia and South Asia, these dishes that and ingredients that I never heard of. So, I mean, and I'm not like an expert or anything, but I do have a few Korean books on my shelf and a few Vietnamese cookbooks on my shelf. Right. But you have something like Vietnamese coconut pancakes, which I didn't know was a thing. And this Korean bread with an egg in the middle, Korean egg bread, just for an example. I mean, how did you find all these incredibly tasty and delightful dishes from around Asia?
Well, you know, the thing is, when I was researching for my vegan column, I had a very tiny baby, and ordinarily what I would do when I was writing recipes for the, you know, previous two Indian books that I'd written, I would go and spend months, a year in India, just traveling, taking dog leg turns, the moment where someone would say, oh, there's this incredible dish here, you must go and try it. Whereas with this book, it was what I realized was that it, you know, I couldn't do that for a start, but I started thinking about my own family, and we're Gujarati, and we're Indians from the west coast of India. And the food that my mother cooks and my aunts cook, and my grandma cooks, are generations old. They're very pure recipes. And I thought, well, if we're here, and the UK is such a multicultural country, then there must be many cooks of different cultures that I can go and talk to. And so mm-hmm. I became a real botherer. And by that, I mean, I started following Indonesian cooks, and they might be based in Surrey, just down the road, uh-huh. or they get someone online, and I would just send them Instagram messages, just slide a DM uh-huh. into their inbox, and just ask them questions. Uh-huh. And there's a Korean community here in the UK in New Malden. I have to confess, I don't know exactly why there's such a large community in New Malden, but there's an enormous Korean supermarket there. And so I would just go and chat to people in the supermarket, pick up ingredients, experiment with them. I did some of my traveling via other cookbooks as well and other food writers. And so I have been doing it. So it's the way that quite a lot of us travel, I think, is through our cookbooks.
I certainly do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unusual to be interested in both travel and food at the same time, and cookbooks for me are that sort of amazing nexus of both of those wonderful things. And I've often sort of followed Fuchsia Dunlop down, different alleyways in Chengdu and Mana Jaffrey. I open a book and I'm right there with Mana Jaffrey in 1970s Jakarta suddenly. Yeah. So I think I really had to work quite hard to really just pull in as much information and references and just talk to people. I was in touch with a Saraswati Brahmin cook via WhatsApp, and I was messaging her, and she just rang me back. Like you and I are just chatting like this, and you're based in New York and I'm based in East London right now. Mm-hmm. I was able to have proper conversations with her. And that's what's incredible about the modern world. And it doesn't seem quite as romantic a way to find a recipe, because as a food writer, what I really want to be able to tell you is that I was traveling in a boat somewhere where someone handed me this wonderful thing, and I was in some incredible market, and the birds were singing, and I don't know, or I was in the middle of a monsoon and I had this experience. But that's not the truth here. And
nobody's traveling now anyway, so no, it's okay.
No one's traveling now anyway. But my real pleasure comes from finding out what people are cooking for themselves and their families in their own kitchen. So what I love doing is reaching out and speaking to, it's predominantly women who are cooking at home. And that's what I did. I did a lot of chatting to people, and so I've done that, I've definitely referenced it in the recipe. So there's a recipe for Shuko's breakfast noodles, and Shuko is she set up a restaurant called Koya in London, and it's in Soho, which is unfortunately closed right now. But I just have the most amazing udon noodles, and it's like a 3-ingredient dish. So there's udon noodles, egg yolks, soy sauce, and there's an optional nori. Yeah. And oh my gosh, I mean, what a dish that is. You just get the hot noodles, break in an egg yolk, season it with the soy sauce, and you have yourself like a really fantastic meal. It just feels very complete. So that's really how I went about East. But obviously the other thing to say here is that before I had my children, before COVID, I did used to travel, and so I have done a fair amount of traveling, since I left university, just around, and I've always sort of followed my mouth and my nose. But mm-hmm. And that's just how that's just the best way, isn't it?
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful experience. I love that you write that learning from other home cooks what people are actually cooking in their homes for their families is really some of the most fascinating stuff, some of the most fascinating food out there. I totally agree. I think that it's wonderful that your book also captures the very real conversation that food throughout East, Southeast, and South Asia has always had. So there's like these dishes that have come from these migrants from different areas and you know, throughout the region. So for instance, I'm looking at the recipe you have for chili tofu. And this was inspired by a dish from the first Indo-Chinese restaurant. Is that right? Or chili paneer?
Yeah, so it's not, it wasn't the first Indo-Chinese restaurant, but I mean, there's always been a little bit of transference from China to India.
Oh, sorry, you wrote that the first Indo-Chinese restaurant opened in Kolkata just 85 years ago. Never mind. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so Indian Chinese food, or it's been given its own name, Chindian. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I didn't know that. Okay.
I think it's very, very popular when Indians go out to eat. They love eating Chinese food, but it's not real Chinese food. It's Chindian food, or a sort of an amalgamation. And it's its own thing, and Indians love it. And so chili paneer, which is what I've based the chili tofu on, is a really probably the most famous Chinese Indian dish, or Indo-Chinese dish, whichever way around you want to. And it's sort of where you hard fry the tofu, so you get that lovely crisp edge, and then braise it, you sort of fry it in corn flour, and then braise it in a sort of sticky, sweet, spicy sauce. And it's just one of those things that you cannot possibly stop eating, because it just has it. I mean, I can't stop eating it. It has a power over me that I cannot explain, but, you know, I'm sure, it falls within the things that we now know that make food like that delicious, in that it's hot, salty, it has umami, it's got all the things that you
soy sauce, tomato based, it's got all the umami.
Yes, exactly. It's got everything going on for it. And I still am not sure. I agonized over the portion size when I was writing, because I was like, I could polish this whole thing off myself. I don't know how to create, you know, servings for four people. And
it looks so good.
I was just so greedy.
Yeah, Mira, and this is the one that you said really turned you on to tofu, right?
Yes, that's right. Because I have to say, and I, you know, there are just some ingredients that that you don't love the first time around, and I was a very fussy eater as a child, so I think I'm quite a sensitive person, so that happened to me a lot when I was growing up, is that I would turn off something, but then when I realized just how, you know, that you could treat tofu in so many different ways, the different types of tofu, I love this technique where you hard fry the tofu first to sort of seal the tofu, and you can crisp it, and then you braise it and it becomes chewy. Yeah. And that's my favorite way of eating tofu, I think. I mean, to be honest, I'm a real tofu, evangelical tofu pusher now. But whoever will listen, I love all the different types of tofu. I'm a big fan of silken tofu as well, which I don't think very many people have really got to grips with in their kitchens. I don't know how you feel about it, but what I love about it is that you can buy it fresh, but it's quite hard to buy fresh here in London. And so I buy it in a carton, in a sort of cardboard box.
Sits
in my pantry, and so it doesn't even need cooking, or it takes minutes to cook, and it's an incredible vehicle for whatever flavor you want to throw at it. And it provides, in the same way that sort of coconut milk, how we were talking earlier, how it's sort of a blanket or a foil for other sort of much bigger, brasher flavors. Silken tofu does that too.
And I love how you have a silken tofu based vegan mayo recipe.
Yes.
Brilliant.
it's delicious. It really is. Like, it's not, to what I was saying earlier, what I've really tried to do is not make substitutes, and so that when you're eating them, you feel like you're eating like a poor man's mayo.
Yeah.
Or the poor woman's mayo. But it's, that's the thing. It just has all of these wonderful properties to it. Mm-hmm. And it just makes a fantastic, like, sauce, let's call it mayonnaise. But what's joyful about it is that you're not eating, you know, quite as much oil as you would be if you were making your own mayonnaise. I mean, I love mayonnaise, so I'm not going to say a bad word against it. But anyway, it makes a fantastic sauce. So.
And to your point, you know, of being a tofu evangelist, I think that I can't see why anyone would not like that chili tofu dish. I mean, it's I think that a lot of people maybe just haven't had tofu served to them in too many ways or in the right way.
Yes.
So you gotta just try it.
Well, I think that's true of all vegan food, I would say, is that it had such a bad reputation, or, you know, it was so politicized, and like being a vegetarian was even, I wouldn't say frowned upon, but it was definitely on the fringes of society. You know, let's say 20 years ago or so, because I was a vegetarian 20 years ago, and I don't remember being catered for very easily by people. Yeah. And I really think it's just a question of people just eating delicious food and then just realizing that it is vegan. And instead of, there are so many arguments for eating more vegetables, and no one ever said that eating more vegetables is bad for you. But really, it's just having delicious food to eat that you feel is substantial and wonderful, and you just want more of it, whether it's vegan or not. I think that's that way you're not sort of pushing an elephant up a hill by sort of telling people that it's good for them.
Exactly. I know. Or being didactic or anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay, let's talk. I think I found it. This is on page 133. You have Brussels sprout nasi goreng, which is just ingenious. It looks like you completely frizzled up the Brussels sprouts. And is this your invention? Is this
the shredding of the sprouts?
Nasi goreng? Or just recreating it as nasi goreng?
The dish is my invention, but I don't know if I was the first person to ever shred sprouts. I think I actually had a sort of, was it the Zuni Cafe? Yeah, I think it was.
Zuni Cafe.
I had a sprout salad there with parmesan and lemon. Yeah. So I definitely have not been the first person to shred a sprout. But I do love, that's how I love eating them, shredded. Yeah. And so this dish, what I love about this recipe that you're talking about is that you can quickly cook sprouts, and they are essentially mini cabbages, and they cook so quickly, and they're quite sweet and tender little things. And so I've sort of used I've used sprouts cooked into some rice that's flavored with ketchup manis and soy sauce, tomato puree, and it ends up tasting quite sort of dirty, like it's quite a filthy, delicious dish. is how I would describe it. Like when I made it, I was like, wow, this tastes like really like it's like takeaway food in the best possible way. But then I use the rest of the sprouts as a sort of fresh salad to disguise the sort of how filthy it tastes. And
contrast.
And that's really because they have this beautiful, they are delicious raw. And so they, you know, they really hold their own as like a little salad that you can treat quite mercilessly. So I've used bird's eye chilies and garlic, and I'm trying to remember off the top of my head some like vinegar it's a fresh little salad to just sort of contrast against this quite
I never would have thought of doing combining the shaved Brussels sprouts with such a dirty, I wouldn't call it dirty, but as you called it dirty.
They did. But also really great this time of year, because I don't know, I mean, sprout farmers must spend all year round just growing these sprouts until just before Christmas time or Thanksgiving. Is it traditional to eat sprouts at Thanksgiving?
I think it's popular.
Popular. Okay. So yeah. then you're suddenly left with like a lot of sprouts in the farmers markets. Right. And so it's quite, you know, it's quite useful to have a sprout recipe up your sleeves to
that's true.
To use up, you know, that big bag that's lying around.
And, those farmers. Yeah. All right. Good to keep in mind. Mira, there are so many brilliant recipes in here. We didn't even scratch the surface of so many of them, but it looks like that's about all the time we have for today. Although I do hope everyone checks out Mira Soda's East from Flatiron Books, which is in beautiful. And I have to say the photos are incredible too.
Oh, thank you.
The hardcover. It's a wonderful tome, and I love all the, oh my goodness, look at these beautiful cabbages you have here and the eggplants. Oh, there's just like so many different categories of food in this book, but it's vegetarian. So thank you so much for your time today. And, what do you hope people take away from this book, if anything, in a nutshell?
Well, I really hope that they take away, you know, just how easy it is to eat vegan and vegetarian food and to sort of transform a squash into a meal for four. And that with just a few store cupboard ingredients and a couple of, you know, a few base ingredients like noodles and rice and, you know, a singular fresh vegetable from the farmer's market, you can really eat the most fantastic stuff. So it's not, I don't know if people think it could be intimidating to start eating more plants, but I'm here to say it's not. It's easy. It can be very quick. It's certainly very delicious. And I hope East can help people with a, you know, I feel like we're as an earth going through this journey to try and figure out a way to eat more plants. And this is, I just hope people join me on this for this ride.
Perfect. I'll be joining you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right, Amira. Thanks everyone at Heritage Radio Network. And we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.